go into a vortex when you write things. Like, well, anyway, I'm Rick Hansen. It's September 27th, 2017. And as you know, we've been exploring mindfulness and relationships, mainly. And lately, I've been reflecting about courage and its relevance for interpersonal mindfulness and relationships in general. So I want to take a swing at that topic. It's relevant, I think, at many scales, dealing with health issues, dealing with financial worries, dealing with interpersonal tensions, and then also scaling up. How do we meet the moment? How do we meet this time in human history? How do we respond to things that are happening with courage? So, on reflection, people use that word in many different ways, in my experience. And I'm going to not try to do justice to the fullness of that topic in every possible way. I suspect we're going to keep going with this thread for another evening or two. My own focus on this is really through the lens of the root of the meaning of the word, which is heart. Heart. I don't know how they pronounce it in French. I'm sure someone does. Of course, he would. Gabriel would know. So there's heart. We take heart. We find heart. We are of good heart. We have heart. So I want to talk about three things on the foundation of one thing. So the one thing is just simply to call out that practice that I referred to in the meditation instructions a couple of times, that sense of being all right already. A sense of, even if there's pain or distress or disturbance around the edges, somehow in the core, there's a letting go of resistance to the moment, a letting go of grasping after anything else, and a letting go of any sort of clinging or disturbance interpersonally. There's a sense, in other words, in the core, at least in that moment, of enough peacefulness, enough contentment, and enough love. In the moment. And then, 10,000 times, 10 seconds at a time, we register again and again that wholesome moment, and in the process of that, literally hardwire over time a resilient well-being into our own body. So that as the waves of life come at us and smack on us, they don't capsize our little boat. We don't drown in them. We may take on some serious water, but after a reasonable amount of time, we recover and keep on sailing. And so that's a real foundation. It's difficult, it's possible, but it's a lot harder to be courageous if deep inside you're enormously disturbed. In the moment, you're traumatized. You feel desperate inside. Isolated, inadequate, unloved, in that moment, it's just harder to have courage, I think. So one of the things we can do is again and again and again, feed our core, the animal core of the body. It's the body that needs to feel safe. It's the body that needs to feel satisfied and connected. Again and again and again, helping that little furry animal feel strong and able, deep down inside. That's really foundational. It's cultivation of a core of resilience and well-being. Okay, that's a foundational practice. And daily life gives us many opportunities to register that kind of experience if we just show up for it. You're exhaling and you naturally relax. You cannot help but relax as you exhale because the heart rate slows a little as we exhale. There are many moments to feel that you're with someone who in that moment wishes you no harm. Their hands are open. They carry no weapons. They bear you no malice. They're friendly, actually. There's an opportunity for that. And there are many, many moments, independent of what's happening around us, where we can feel inside ourselves a sense of capability, a sense of resourcefulness, determination, honorableness, goodness inside ourselves. We have so many opportunities to really take that in. That's foundational. Okay. On that foundation, I'd like to talk about three things and leave plenty of time for conversation. The first is fear. Talk about fear, because courage isn't really relevant unless there's fear involved in some way, or fear could be involved in some way. And I'm thinking here of one of the scariest things I ever did in my life. I was 15, shy, nervous around girls. I lived in Finland. I went to a boys' school, a Swedish boys' school. It's 1967, 68. And they had a dance in the spring of the year where the girls who went to the girls' school and the boys who went to the boys' school would have a dance. And my friends said, "So you want us to get you a date, right?" And I had to represent for the Americans, the Californians. So I said, "Yeah." And I ended up meeting this wonderful woman, young woman. She was an older woman. She was 17. I was 15. And Christine is her name. And I fell in love. And it was real love. You know, first real love, no different from adult love, in my experience. And I was due to leave the country in only a couple months later. So there's a real sense of compression there. And I realized that I was in love with her, and I wanted to tell her, and I needed to tell her. And it was so scary. I had no idea what she would say. In my own family, I had constricted myself and withheld my love and my war with my mother in particular. And the thought of pushing those words through the tight valve of my own throat was very frightening, and I did not know what she would do. And I remember really finding my courage, and I chose the occasion, and we went for a walk, and I even said it to her in Swedish, which I learned at the time, which made it feel slightly safer. I don't know why I said it in English too, but I finally got it out. I said it, "I love you." And she said, after an eternal 3 seconds, "I love you too." So, but it was a good ending, and yet I would have been courageous even if it hadn't turned out that way. But the point is, courage often, I think, is involved in places where we don't normally think of it. I've done numerous crazy, hairy things in the mountains where some kind of functioning was called for in very dangerous circumstances. And in many ways, that moment where I'd really, really, really pull it together to speak was one of the scariest moments of my life, and one of the times where I most had a felt sense of courage. So I think it's real important to not underestimate when courage is called for. And so what do we do with fear? Fear is what often shadows our courage, it smothers it. The Buddha taught a lot about what we do when things are unpleasant, because that's very much when fear is involved. There's a tendency to want to push it away, or as I write about it, you can see more about this, we don't want to risk the dreaded experience. It's dreaded. We're afraid of it. We don't want it to happen. We're very uncomfortable in what we might feel if we said that thing, or were seen in that way, or spoke truth to power in some way. So, couple of teachings here. One is to not privilege fear. Fear is an experience like any other experience. It's like hearing. It's like seeing. There are two great experiences we tend to privilege. One is fear, and the other is the experience of self. So if we relate to the experience as an experience like the taste of a raisin, or the pressure on our hand, or a memory or a thought, it's just an experience. It doesn't have so much power over us. We're not so rattled by it. And with repetition, with frequent ways of relating to fear in that way, as unpleasant and often important to listen to, consequential, not to be fought, but on the other hand, to not privilege it, to not give it a dominion or power over us. To do that again and again and again is a really useful thing to do. And after a while, the fear is there. The fear is there. The heart is pounding. My heart is going a million miles an hour that afternoon above the city of Turku in Finland. But we keep on going. So it's interesting to explore relationship with fear and to take that on as an object of of meditation and mindfulness. I remember my supervisor, when I was learning how to be a therapist, say one of his main practices when he's working with people was, as he put it, to follow anxiety. It's very useful to follow anxiety in your own mind, especially down deeper. What is it I'm anxious about? It's not the circumstances or events we're anxious about, really, at bottom. It's what we'd experience if they occur. That's what is often most uncomfortable for us. So to be aware of the fear. And also related to that, a practice I do routinely, and I've done for a number of years now, which is to be aware of subtleties of baseless fear. And in the moment, again and again and again, let go of needless anxiety. You can watch it in your mind. Everything's perfectly fine. You know you're safe, and yet you feel uneasy, like a primal unease. I think of it in biology and evolution, it's to me plausible that we evolved it as kind of a resting state of primal apprehensiveness, because it primed our ancestors to be on the lookout. Obviously, in certain situations, there's a place for primal apprehensiveness, walking through a dark parking lot late at night, perhaps. Thinking about how to deal with a situation with the IRS. But on the whole, we really don't need it. There might be a challenge, there might be a threat, there might be a thing to deal with, but we don't need to have fear added to it. So it's a very interesting practice to, in your body, to just keep letting go of apprehensiveness. As you get up and walk out of here at the end tonight, can you walk across this room to that door without one atom of fear in your mind for the 15 seconds it takes you to walk across the room? When you're talking with someone, to have absolutely no fear while you're with them. You might be perceiving what's going on, but you don't need to have any fear added to it. That's a profound practice to do again and again and again. And it reminds me of this core teaching of the Buddha I reflect on a lot. He says, one who can recite the sacred scriptures is not called wise. One is called wise who is peaceable, friendly, and fearless. That combination, peaceable, friendly, and fearless. So it's interesting to explore authentic fearlessness in those many moments in our life when there's a legitimate basis for it. So that's the first topic, fear, really? An exploration of fear. Okay, great. Second little topic I want to drop in about courage is a fundamental core inside the self of will and determination. And I think of the Buddha's own life. And like many good lessons, it's kind of a mixed story. Fundamentally, he was a well-to-do householder, young prince, as best we know. And right around the time in his late 20s, probably, that his wife was about to have a child, or just had had a child, he abandoned them all, and he walked away into homelessness. Took up vows of poverty, essentially, and he just walked away. Now, from our perspective, and perhaps perspective then, there are a lot of issues with that. A father abandoning his family. Maybe that father was aware of a network of kin and relative affluence in that setting, but still. On the other hand, with that knowledge and a lot of ways to look at that, including looking at it, you know, to what extent is appropriate to look at events 2,500 years ago through our modern lenses and all that. In addition to all that, alongside all that, you really can get a sense in the Buddha's own journey for the next 7 or so years, complete, independent, autonomous determination to understand what caused suffering, including its persistent subtleties, and how to be utterly liberated from it. And the Buddha went from teacher to teacher to teacher, and he mastered, apparently, what each one taught, but he knew it wasn't enough. And there was that sense that one is oneself responsible for one's own awakening, that we can draw upon others, we can ask others to help us, but it's really up to us ultimately to guide our own course in this life. That doesn't mean ignoring others. Hopefully it doesn't mean abandoning your partner and child. But there is a core there of willfulness. And to be honest, it's a story I don't tell much. I've written about it. One of the central experiences of my life happened when I was about 6 years old. I think I was probably six, barely, maybe. And I was living in Illinois at the time with my family. I can really see it in the moment. And I'm standing on the edge of the cornfield, on the edge of our suburban home in Illinois. And I can literally see there was rain and there were ruts in the dirt from tractors, I think. And I could see the water gathered there. And I could see my house in the distance, 100 feet away, 200 feet away, the light, yellow light coming out from some windows. And in my heart, I was aware of the unhappiness in that home, the bickering, the tension, the anger. I don't remember the details. But I absolutely clearly remember this fundamental sense of being a little six-year-old or five-year-old kid with a kind of wistful sadness about what was there and a deep knowing somehow that it wasn't about me fundamentally. It wasn't about me fundamentally. I had to deal with it, but it wasn't really about me. But what was about me was I had to find my own way. And literally, it's quite sacred actually to me. There was a sense, there was a, in the distance, foothills, not sure how far away, lights twinkling, I could see other homes. And I had this really core feeling that it would be up to me to find my way eventually to what those lights represented, other happier people and relationships and healthier ways of being. I didn't know how I would do it, and I didn't have a grandiose fantasy of some superpower or magic carpet. It was really quite fundamental, very poignant. I was aware of the difficulties. I was just a little boy. But in my core, there was a knowing that it was up to me to find my own way. I think that's really central. So if we're going to have courage in how we deal with things, a great resource for that is that core of autonomy, will, essence, agency. So many forces arrayed against us, and yet we can exercise agency, influence over what we can affect, including what we choose ultimately to walk away from and what we choose ultimately, if only in our own minds, to walk toward, to join with. It's really central also to courage. And then the last thing, is to be courageous, including interpersonally. One of the things that so helps is to feel that others are with you. Maybe they're not literally physically with you. One of the things that was so scary for me, it made it so hard to find my courage when I told Christina I loved her, was I really felt alone. I didn't have a lot of internalization at that point in my life at 15 of feeling loved or allied with. I was awkward, socially isolated, tensions in my family. And that was really hard. And I think about, it's not particularly my culture, so I want to say this with a lot of, with the respect that I have and no presumption of knowledge, but I think about so many of the cultures around the world, particularly the first people, the indigenous cultures, the deep roots of humanity, how often there's an emphasis on feeling that others are with you as you meet life. Your ancestors are with you. The spirits are with you. The animals are with you. Nature is with you. The divine is with you. Something is with you. And as you face the things that call for courage yourself, who's with you? Who do you feel is with you? Who would wish you well? Or who have you internalized along the way? If only in your imagination. I mean, Walt Whitman put it, I am multitudes. In other words, we are multitudes. We have, it's complex in there. It's diversified inside the mind, just like the brain is a diversified network. The body is a collection of systems of systems. We are multitudes. So what are the multitudes? Who are the multitudes that are with you? And one of the things lately I've been reflecting about is that I will almost certainly, at least in this body, not meet my great-grandchildren, particularly at the rate our kids are going. No children yet, let alone grandchildren, let alone great-grandchildren. So you think about it, I think it's very poignant to me to say that my mother's father never met his daughter's son. And my great-grandparents certainly never met me. And yet, if I think about my great-grandchild, a great-grandchild, if I'm fortunate and have one, and that person is fortunate to live, I would wish that person well. I'd be deeply interested in the welfare of that person. And it's not that I'd restrict that to just my kid, but you know, it has that feeling in it. Well, flip it around. Think about your ancestors, your great-grandparents, who, if they could be here today and knew something of your life and then knew something of the challenges you're facing, would so wish you well. And of course, there are other allies as well, people we've internalized along the way. You can imagine them in your mind. Think about how you are for others as they face their challenges. If you could be inside their mind as they're frightened, and still there's that thing for them to do or to face or to deal with or risk, you'd be encouraging them and courage. You'd be giving them heart in the same way. It's really helpful to feel that others are with you, too. Which then takes it into the last thing I want to say here, which in the sense, in the way that we can feel that we're being carried or supported by our inner allies, you know, the team. It's kind of like you're the local representative of the team. The team's behind you. They really are wishing that you'll kick that ball through the goalposts or score that sale or cure that illness. The team's behind you. You know, it's a feeling of being carried along. And I think one thing that gets often in the way of courage is taking things personally, getting caught up in self. If we relax the sense of self, we relax the sense of trying to protect ourselves from embarrassment or what it might look like or overdoing, you know, how bad it would be, then it's a lot easier to be courageous. The opportunity is to feel that you're, in a way, carried along by your own will. You're carried along by whatever is the right thing to do. And it doesn't matter how you feel. There's simply what there is to do. So it's like the moment, whether it's society or dealing with an illness or speaking up to someone who's a bully, it's like you kind of get out of your own way. It's not so much you are doing it, but rather you're allowing goodness or wisdom or morality or justice or the greater good or what's deeply good to you for you in a deeply healthy way, like telling someone you love her because you really do and time is running out. Let that carry you along. Let that carry you along and get out of its way. What do you make of all that? Courage. Applied to many kinds of things. Spiritual courage, so much of Buddhism is about the courage to face our experience directly, the courage to face impermanence, mortality, directly, the courage to not hide behind unwise speech, but to keep our heart open and hold people in our heart, even as we speak the truth, many kinds of courage. So.
I've been in situations where I've done things that I've been proud of that took courage, And I would imagine it happened in your case also, but there's a feeling of wholeness. One way I would describe it, after you make that kind of leap.
Thank you.
Of courage, faith.
A sense of wholeness in yourself after you do something courageous, yeah. I'm trying to repeat the question or comment more for the recording, but yeah, exactly. That's really true. Tom?
Yeah, I was just responding to your talking about wanting to, or thinking about your grandchildren,
yeah.
Your great-grandfather. In the last 6 months, I've gotten taken up with genealogy pretty heavily, and in an obsessive-compulsive way. And but I found my 16th great-grandfather, in the 1300s. And some people, when I get talking about this kind of thing, some people will say, well, why do you do that? And another might say, well, I feel this, we're all family. But I have found a great sense of connection with the world.
Uh-huh.
Not so much the family, his ancestor, great grandfathers and grandmothers, but it has been very grounding for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. Feeling your connection upstream.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Thank you. I have a little suggestion to you all. If you make it real for yourself, there are many places to be courageous. Think about your relationships and something that your heart is moved to say but is scary to you. Maybe it's expressing anger. Maybe it's expressing love. Maybe it's expressing remorse. It's scary to admit the thing. Whatever it might be, it's interesting to ask yourself, what is that? And how could you resource yourself, maybe related to some of the topics I brought up tonight, to do that hard thing? It gets very real, really fast. Yeah.
I find the whole topic of fear so fascinating, and I'm so aware of just how much fear is in our culture right now, and it seems like there's so much bad behavior out there that really seems like fear is at the core of its motivation. And just thinking about myself, I was actually having this conversation with this fabulous friend of mine today who happens to be your wife. And we were talking about just how we deal with difficult situations, and we were talking about, the boundaries of it and binding and how our minds go to, let's first explore the worst that could happen. And then when we can acknowledge that it's really not as bad as kind of our racing heart was suggesting, then we can get more to a letting go of it.
Yeah.
But just that whole neurophysiological negativity bias instinct of wanting control by anticipating the worst that can happen sometimes gets me into a spiral of before I know it, I'm there, and it's hard to reel it back in and feel like, actually right now I am okay.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you have any advice about that, because, I do have, one of my mantras is, it's only fear, it's only sadness, it's only anger, whatever it only is, and then letting it go, because it is only that, it's only for a moment, and it's everything changes, etc. But it doesn't feel like it's only fear sometimes. It feels like, oh my God, how am I going to deal with this? The world is coming to an end when my prefrontal cortex is not functioning. And I don't know if you have advice or some words of wisdom in those moments.
Oh, I've reflected on it a lot. And so the question, what do we do when we're triggered? How to deal with that? When we really get captured by it? And that first thing I said, I think, is really important, because again and again and again, if we internalize ordinary, authentic, healthy experiences, we do really build up a resilient core. So much evidence for that. So many different kinds of evidence for that. And people start at different places when they do that. They're dealing with different challenges. But to me, one of the things that, and again, it goes all the way back to that idea of that self-determination, that for the Buddhist story and my own story as a six-year-old, that no one can stop you from strengthening your own tent pole, your own inner core, your own inner keel. Literally, you could be in a horrible situation, objectively, and internally, there's always at least one thing you can do that day to make your core a little bit stronger, a little bit more resilient, a little bit more adaptive, a little bit more resourced. No one can stop you from that. And knowing that is itself a resource to take in. And I swear I'm going to do a workshop called Buddhist Aggressiveness is Not an Oxymoron, but I think there's a place, really I do, where you tune into a kind of feral, fierce independence. It says, I don't care what you're doing out there. In my own mind, in my own temple, I'm the guardian. I'm the steward of my own temple. And that right there is great, again and again and again. And the faster we can call that up in the moment, even the better. So that's, to me, one thing. Second thing is, if you think of, for me, Buddhist practices tend to cluster into two categories that are relevant here. One category is somatic, very in your body, where you grapple again and again and again with the unpleasant, and you learn to tolerate the unpleasant. I think of this story I heard, Temple Smith. No, not Temple Grandin. This is a man who, he's a teacher, Spirit Rock teacher. Okay, so Temple tells a story. He goes to Asia to train as a young monk for 6 months, quick story. And every morning they go out with alms bowls at 5 or 6 in the morning to have food put into their bowl. That's what they lived on in that environment. And they walked barefoot. And the first time they went out, Temple was horrified that he'd have to walk on gravel with bare feet. And he was really angry at the abbot. What's wrong with you? Why can't we go on the sidewalk? And what about sandals? And this is crazy, right? So he confronts the abbot when he can, you know, in a respectful way. And the abbot goes, uh-huh, unpleasant, right? And then he just chews him out of his room. You're like, unpleasant. So the point is not to inflict unpleasantness, but that life has a certain amount of unpleasantness. So there are visceral practices we do again and again where we learn to tolerate unpleasant, including the unpleasantness of fear and the unpleasantness of what we're afraid of. So instead of warding it off and fearing it so much, we just simply learn to tolerate it. And there are other somatic practices as well, the cultivation of loving kindness, compassion. They're very visceral. They're very emotional. That's one cluster of practices. And as we do those practices, we become increasingly peaceable, friendly, and fearless. On the one hand. The other cluster of practices is more perceptual. And they have gotten a lot of the glamour in the last 20 years as Buddhism has come to the West. Insight practices, recognition of impermanence, recognition of the kind of frothy, insubstantial emptiness of all experiences. They exist, but you can't cling to them. It's how we see them. And it's interesting. And I want to just speak to the latter just for a moment here. That, for me at least, it has really helped me to see things as eddies in the river of time, eddies in the stream. And you're an eddy, I'm an eddy, the sun is an eddy, Trump is an eddy, El Capitan, the sun, the Milky Way, the thought, this moment of experience, they're all eddies in a stream. We're all, and so there's this balance where you recognize your interdependence with all the other currents in the river of causes. But on the other hand, you recognize the suchness of this particular ripple right now. It's independence of that ripple alongside it. So that ripple alongside it is frightened. That fear does not need to invade my eddy in the stream. I get to choose whether I too should be scared of the thing you're scared of, but I don't presume. So there's a kind of perception. It's felt, maybe starts intellectual, it gets more felt, that you're rippling through life alongside all these other eddies. And they have their own particularity due to all their own causes. You have your own particularity, your own suchness. And you don't need to be invaded by or implicated in that other eddy in the stream. There's a differentiation. It's, same way. Just because they're threatening doesn't mean you need to be frightened. To the point, because we are vulnerable to fear, it's been such an age-old tendency to whip up fear at all scales. Preschool, junior high, Washington, D.C., Fox News, threat level orange, and of any kind, all kinds. And for me, it's been actually a real practice to draw a real line when I, as soon as I can see that someone's trying to make me more afraid than I in my own inner temple feel I need to be afraid, that's a big bell ringing in my mind. It's a temple bell, hopefully, some of the time. But like that's really important, too. We are often invaded by fear. There's a term, emotional contamination. And to just kind of go, no. I don't need to feel threatened by or implicated in or demanded upon. No, I hear you. I'll autonomously decide how to respond, but I don't need to feel that your demands are controlling upon me. That's a really important thing, including the demands of situations. Just to feel a kind of freedom. And you see this in people who are very far along in their practice. They're utterly present and utterly free in relationship to what's happening around them. There's that quality. And it's a very interesting quality to cultivate. You're both utterly related and utterly unimplicated. Just find your way into that. Feel your way into that. That's very powerful, too. Last person, Beth.
The Yetis that you're talking about, I've always been quite fearless and had my own drummer.
Have been what again?
And my own drummer.
Yes.
In a loving and kind way.
Yeah.
And my life has been really, really smooth. And the two most important people in my life, you can all relate to this and have children, are my two children that are now these Yetis in this stream. As I'm making my final decisions of where I want my life to go here at the end. And it's friction. And we've had a great relationship. I'm going to say, you know, a 90%er. And all at once the friction, these two Eddies that are having a problem with my sense of, I'll do it my way. And there's... they're coming from a position of love, of wanting to put me in some little soft cotton balls. And that isn't the way I have in mind. I think jumping out of a parachute sounds like a whole lot more fun. This just isn't my style.
And I got it.
I have to really say, I don't know where to go with it.
Yeah.
Because it's becoming gnarly.
Yeah.
And this should be a really good time, not an hour.
Well, thank you for saying that. And you reminded me right there, Bev, of many different ways to be courageous and a description of Thich Nhat Hanh that I think about as, if people don't know him, as a peace activist, a monk, and a Buddhist teacher, also dealing with his own serious stroke and toward the end of his own life, probably. And he was described as, and you reminded me of this right here, as a combination of a cloud, a butterfly, and a bulldozer. And I think that, too, is a way to be courageous, to have that kind of steady bulldozer quality. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Let's keep on this. Next time, I think I'll try to get into more particulars about interpersonal situations where we feel we need to assert ourselves, or we feel someone is being aggressive toward us, or we're afraid of what might happen if we say something. Anyway, keep your heart open. Find courage. How about we sit for a minute, and we'll finish. Take good care. See you next week.
Thank you. I'll see.